We come now to the next 6 years then, brothers and sisters, of our study. And that takes us to the years AD 48 to 53. And what we're going to find is that around about AD 48 there was a controversy that erupted again in the ecclesial world that, surprise, surprise, happened to be associated with the activities of the circumcision party. And of course, that is the story that we're going to look at, God willing, in the record of Acts 15 this morning. We believe that shortly after that controversy began, that Paul wrote his epistle, the epistle of the Galatians, to the Gentile believers in that region. And that he in fact wrote his epistle before travelling up to Jerusalem in order to attend the famous Jerusalem conference of Acts 15. And we believe that that conference took place in the year AD 50, and that in that particular chapter, as we're going to look at it this morning, we're going to see the work and the influence of James in trying now to resolve this particular controversy once and for all. And then a few years later, in about AD 53, Paul was going to make yet a fourth visit to the Jerusalem Ecclesia in order that he might report on the progress of the truth amongst the Gentiles. So we're starting our study then this morning in around about AD 48. James has already been established quite firmly as the leader of the Jerusalem Ecclesia. Remember, it was only about 3 or 4 years before this that Paul had gone to meet James and discuss the doctrine of justification by faith in Galatians chapter 2. And subsequent to that, the Apostle Paul had then travelled on his first missionary journey, which is recorded, of course, in Acts chapter 13 and 14. So he had gone on that missionary journey shortly after the discussion with James on this question of the basis on which the Gentiles might be accepted into the truth. And so now we come to the story of Acts chapter 15, which is after the first of Paul's missionary journeys has come to an end. Because we're told in Acts 14 and verse 26, "And they sailed to Antioch, from whence they had been recommended to the grace of God for the work which they fulfilled. And when they were come and had gathered the ecclesia together, they rehearsed all that God had done with them, and how he had opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles, and there they abode long time with the disciples." So the first missionary journey was around about AD 46. They have now returned to the ecclesia of Antioch, or at least Paul and Barnabas have, and they are now there resident in the years AD 46, 47 and 48, and around about that time the controversy of Acts 15 begins. Now look what Acts 15 verse 1 says then. "Certain men which came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, except ye be circumcised." Now who might that be, do you think, that could have come along to propagate that story? You see, what we're being told here is that the circumcision party had now spread their wings. Not content with disrupting merely the Jerusalem ecclesia, they are now seeking to extend the controversy to other meetings. You ever heard about this story before, brothers and sisters, where there's a problem in an ecclesia and all of a sudden somehow it gets moved to another meeting and another meeting? Before you know it, you've got all these other meetings embroiled in the controversy that belong to that first meeting. Well, that's exactly the spirit of the circumcision party. They seek to widen controversy, and they widen it to other parts that initially had nothing to do with the problem, but before they know, they're roped into the story. So Acts 15 and verse 1 says that the members of the circumcision party have now made their way to the Antioch ecclesia. And you see, I think that they did so for they at least thought that was a very good reason. You see, the circumcision party were alarmed at the tremendous growth of the Antioch ecclesia, which was drawing its members from amongst the Gentiles. And as the Antioch Ecclesia grew bigger and bigger and stronger, those of the circumcision party saw the supremacy of the Jerusalem Ecclesia, the mother Ecclesia, as perhaps being threatened. You see, I think there was a great deal of human pride involved in their actions. Of course, they sought to cloak all of that by saying, well, we've got to stand up for the truth. This journey to Antioch is so that we might make a stand for the truth. But secretly underneath that, they were alarmed at the growth of this rather large Gentile ecclesia. And their tone, as normal, was combative, wasn't it? Because you see what the record says in verse 1. They taught the brethren, said, except ye be circumcised, ye cannot be saved. It's very confrontational and dogmatic as usual. That's the spirit of this party. Oh, and by the way, you see what it says, verse 1. I've got to read it carefully. Certain men which came down from Judea. You know, it's a funny thing, but I'd always thought that Antioch lay to the north of Jerusalem, and yet these brethren, as they travelled to the north, came down. Did you notice that in Acts 15 and verse 1? Because they were from the Jerusalem ecclesia, and it didn't matter where they went in the ecclesial world, wherever they went, they were going down. So they came down, and they taught the brethren what the truth of the matter was. And you see, the danger of Judaism, brothers and sisters, lies in its ability to be cloaked with apparently spiritual motives. Sometimes even the issue at stake may be correct, but the underlying motives are the key thing here. Now, what was the issue as far as the circumcision party was concerned? Well, it was really very simple. If they gave way on circumcision, if they allowed that circumcision was not binding, then they gave way to the possibility that all of the law might not be binding. And if that was the case, if the law need not be observed by the Gentiles, then instead of coming into the truth on the basis of being associates of the truth, why, the Gentiles would, they'd come in as equals. And all of their Jewish prejudice told them that that just couldn't possibly be the case, that Gentiles could come into the truth as equal with us Jewish brethren. And so they knew that they had to make a stand on this matter. Their Jewish pride told them that that couldn't be right. You see, circumcision was the thin edge of the wedge. They said, this is going to lead to the whole law being set aside. If we don't make a stand for the truth now, it'll all be lost. And so they encouraged themselves on the basis that they were making a stand for the purity of the truth. And they charged off to other parts of the ecclesial world to do battle on the matter of circumcision. So what we have, therefore, in this chapter is, yet again, controversy with the circumcision party, only now it's widening beyond Jerusalem to other parts of the ecclesial world. Now, it's interesting, brothers and sisters, but we actually have three accounts of this episode of controversy. The first account is given to us here in Acts chapter 15 and verse 1, where it says, and certain men which came down from Judea taught the brethren and said, except ye be circumcised. And we've just added a few words there from verse 5 when it says that it was needful to keep the law of Moses. Now the account of Acts 15 and verse 1 is Luke's record of the story, because Luke, of course, is the writer of the Acts of the Apostles. But do you know that if you come to verse 24 of this same chapter, in Acts 15 and verse 24, we have another account of the same controversy. And, well, this is actually the words of James, you see. This is James summarizing the matter. And in verse 24 he says, forasmuch as we have heard that certain which went out from us have troubled you with words, subverting your souls and saying, ye must be circumcised and keep the law, to whom we gave no such commandment. So this is now James' account of the same controversy. And there is a third account, which is the account of the Apostle Paul himself. Because in Galatians chapter 2, we're told this in verses 12 and 13. It says, "For before that certain came from James, he did eat with the Gentiles," that's Peter, "but when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away." And I believe that the reference in Galatians 2 here is to the same controversy that erupted in the ecclesia in Antioch, as recorded here. You notice, by the way, how the records are complementary. Notice firstly how tactful Luke is. Luke says in Acts 15 verse 1, he simply says that certain men came down from Judea. Don't you think he knew that they came from the Jerusalem ecclesia? Yes, I think he knew that they came from Jerusalem. And James acknowledges that, doesn't it? Because in James's account, in verse 24, he says, "Certain which went out from us." So he knows that they came from the Jerusalem ecclesia. But you see, I think that Luke's account says simply certain men from Judea, because he understood, Luke knew, that these men did not have the spirit of James. But Galatians says that when they did come to Antioch, they implied that they had come with the authority of James. Certain came from James, says Galatians. Now, did they really come from James, brothers and sisters, in the sense of coming with James's authority and approval? And the answer was clearly not. Because James says that in this verse here, verse 24, doesn't he? He says, "To whom we gave no such commandment." Yet Galatians says they came and they represented themselves as coming from James. Why would they say they came from James? Well, simply because James's name carried such authority and credibility in the ecclesial world. And you notice, by the way, that when they did come, they were so strong and so inflexible in the Antioch ecclesia that they even caused Peter to no longer eat with the Gentiles and Barnabas to be carried away by their dissimulation, says the record. You see, these brethren were extraordinarily strong in their agitations. They knew that if they agitated long enough and loud enough, that in the end people would listen and believe and swing to their point of view. So now they've arrived in Antioch, and boy, did everyone know they'd come. You know, you have to picture the scene, brothers and sisters, so let me reconstruct the scene for you in the Antioch ecclesia of the time. You see, I think what happened was this. This is what Acts 15 and verse 1 is really saying. You see, one day in the Antioch ecclesia, there came a knock at the door. The door opened, and these brethren stood there saying, "Hello." And the ecclesia of Antioch said, "Hello." And the other brethren said, "We've come from Jerusalem. From the mother ecclesia." You do know of the Jerusalem ecclesia? Yes, we've come from James. You know James? The Lord's brother. The recorder of the Jerusalem ecclesia. And out of their pocket they pulled a letter of introduction from James. "Now we've come, brothers and sisters, to talk to you about the truth. It's a marvelous thing that all you Gentiles have been called to the truth. It's a wonderful thing that we have the opportunity to share together and to have the chance to be saved. Because God wants us all to be saved, doesn't he, brothers and sisters?" Yes, of course he does. Well, you see, the thing is that down through time, God has given us the key to salvation in his holy law. You see, the law came from Moses. Do you think Moses will be in the kingdom? Yes, of course he'll be in the kingdom, won't he? That's right. Well, Moses taught circumcision. You do know that, don't you? You see, Moses taught that circumcision was vital, that it's always been God's way, you see. It's God's special requirement for his people. It's a sign that they are truly his. And of course, you know what Christ said? Christ said, "Think not that I'm come to destroy the law. I'm not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill the law." In fact, you do know that Christ, he was circumcised too. You know that? Our Lord was circumcised. And of course, he's our example, isn't he? To follow. as best as we possibly can. And did Christ ever break the law? No, he kept it perfectly, didn't he? And that's what we've got to try and do, you see. We've got to try and keep the law. So you see, really, unless you're circumcised and keep the law, you can't actually be saved. And so this is so important that we've come to talk to you about this from James. You know James, of course? He's known as James the Just back home because, well, of course, he keeps the law as scrupulously as he can. See, it's not too hard, is it, brothers and sisters, to cause problems in a meeting. And all of a sudden there would be those who didn't know what to do. It sounded pretty good. And verse 2 of Acts 15 says, when Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them. See, Paul opposed the circumcision party, and he opposed them strongly. Do you know why he opposed them so strongly, brothers and sisters? I'll tell you why. Because I'll tell you exactly what the circumcision party would have done. If the Antioch Ecclesia had given in and said, you're right, we've got to be circumcised, they would have circumcised all these Gentile brethren, and then the circumcision party would have said, well, of course you realise, though, that you've got to be circumcised, verse 1, after the manner of Moses. And of course, you see, Moses did say that it should be on the eighth day. And so you Gentiles have done very well in being circumcised, and we now welcome you as members of the community of the faithful, but they would be second-rate Christadelphians, wouldn't they? Because they weren't circumcised on the eighth day. And the Jews would keep their supremacy in the overall scheme of things, but the truth, brothers and sisters, would have become simply another branch of Judaism with Christ tacked on the end, and the Gentiles as subordinates to the supremacy of the Jewish race. Oh, no wonder Paul had no small dissension with them. You see in verse 2 when it says that he had no small dissension with them, that word dissension is the word translated uproar in Acts 19 verse 40 about the riot in Ephesus. There was a riot in the Antioch Ecclesia. And who brought that uproar into the Ecclesia? Not Paul, brothers and sisters. It was the circumcision party. Because that's the influence of this party. They agitate and they disrupt for their cause. And Ecclesias suddenly find that they're embroiled in terrible controversy. That's the spirit of this group. And so they had sent in envoys all around the ecclesial world. You know what Paul, what James said, by the way, in verse 24? Certain which went out from us have troubled you with words. Now, there's an interesting cross-reference, by the way. You don't need to turn it up. But it was around about this time, just before the Jerusalem conference, that we believe that Paul wrote his epistle to the Galatians. And in Galatians 1 verse 6 he says, I marvel that ye are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ, into another gospel, which is not another, but there be some that trouble you. Galatians 1 verses 6 and 7. And those who were troubling the Galatians at that time were the very members of the circumcision party who had gone forth to trouble other places as well. And so when Paul writes his epistle to the Galatians, it's on the very eve of the Jerusalem conference. Oh, now, by the way, come and have a look at Galatians chapter 5 and just see, therefore, the spirit of Paul as this conference is about to open. So what's his view, then, on the basis of justification? And does he really disagree with James about works? Well, see what he says. Galatians 5 verse 1. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Behold, I, Paul, say unto you that if ye be circumcised, Christ shall profit you nothing. For I testify again to every man that is circumcised, that he is a debtor to do the whole law. Christ is become of no effect unto you. Whosoever of you are justified by the law, ye are fallen from grace. For we through the Spirit wait for the hope of righteousness by faith. For in Jesus Christ neither circumcision availeth anything, nor uncircumcision, Now look at these words. But faith which worketh by love. Did Paul agree with faith and works? Oh yes, I think so. Faith which worketh by love. Well, that's the spirit of the apostle as he is about to go to this conference. He writes Galatians on the very eve of this meeting in Jerusalem. Interesting, by the way, too, look at this. You see, when Paul writes to Galatia in AD 49, James had already written to the diaspora of the Jewish believers only about 3 years before in AD 46. Now, just see if you can see some similarities here. You see, both writers speak about the fact that the true spirit of the law is to manifest love. Now, I've probably put the wrong thing on here. Just una momenta, and I'll just make a slight adjustment and put some other pieces of paper on so that I can now remove these in a more logical fashion. Do you know that it's James who says in James 2, and it should be verse 8, by the way, not verse 10, if you fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself, ye do well. It was James that said that. Do you know the only other writer who refers to the royal law in an epistle? Why, Paul in Galatians 5. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even this, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. Only two places where the royal law is quoted in the writings of the epistles. Where do you think Paul got the idea from? It's James who says, concerning the beneficial influence of spiritual wisdom, he says, but the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. And it's the Apostle Paul who's speaking about the beneficial influence of wisdom is going to say, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. It's James, brothers and sisters, who in writing on the subject of the fact that the truth is revealed in service to other, in service to others, closes his epistle by saying, brethren, if any of you do err from the truth, he which converteth the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul, says James. And you know what Paul writes in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1? Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such an one in the spirit of meekness. You see, I believe that Paul's epistle of Galatians is borrowing from James's epistle of 3 years earlier. You think these two brethren were at one? Oh yes, I think so. I think there was a marvellous spirit of unity and cooperation between these two. And notice which way around it is. Who's copying who? Or who's drawing from who? And the answer is Paul's drawing from James, who of course has written the earlier epistle. Well, down to Jerusalem they went, brothers and sisters. All the members of the circumcision party that had headed north, and Paul and Barnabas have gone down on behalf of the ecclesia of Antioch, because verse 2 says it was determined that they should go to Jerusalem and to speak to the apostles and elders about this question. So now the meeting's about to commence. You know, one writer has said about the Jerusalem conference is that the way the seating was held, I'm not sure how they know this, but apparently it was customary for the time, is there would be rows of older people going back through a hall, and up on a raised platform in a semicircular fashion would be all the apostles and elders on the platform, and James in the very centre as the president, the presiding brother of the conference. And you can just imagine what this meeting must have been like, because it was full of Jews, brothers and sisters. And you know they've always said, don't they, that if you have two Jews, you have at least three opinions. And so this gathering of Jews, and not just Jews, but passionate Jews, passionate on both sides of the ledger, because verse 4 says that when they were come to Jerusalem, they, that is Paul and Barnabas, were received of the ecclesia, and they declared what things God had done with them amongst the Gentiles. But on the other side, verse 5, there are those who rose up saying, yes, it is needful to circumcise them and to command them to keep the law of Moses. As the Jerusalem Bible translates that verse, certain members of the Pharisees' party who had become believers objected, insisting that pagans should be circumcised. So now the battle is joined, and the whole meeting's there. There's a conference now on the question of circumcision party, and the circumcision party, in a sense, have won the day, haven't they? They've brought the thing to such a head now that there is now an entire conference of the ecclesia on this matter, the question of circumcision, and particularly in this context, the question of circumcision and its relationship to Gentile believers. Well, we're not going to go through all the story of Acts 15, but I do want to take up the record from verse 13, which is where James enters the story. Of course, you know what happens in between. Actually, if you really want to just colour in a couple of interesting words in Acts 15 that summarises the whole spirit of the chapter, well, here's the two key words. This is what this whole chapter is about. Verse 5, the word law. And verse 11, the word grace. There it is. That's the whole battle of Acts 15. Law versus grace. Oh, yes, I know it was about circumcision, but behind the circumcision argument, it's essentially a controversy on law versus grace, isn't it? That's what this whole thing's all about. It's two different spirits in the truth. Judaism and the spirit of law-keeping versus what can be inspired by the grace of God's truth working in our lives. And so there were all these different people that came to discuss the matter. And verse 7 says there was much disputing. So this brother stood up and that brother stood up and a Pharisee stood up and Peter stood up and rebutted him and another Pharisee spoke and then Barnabas said something. And so it went on and on and on. Oh, I would have loved to have heard this conference, brothers and sisters. But what we are given, fortunately, is what James did at the conclusion of the matter. Because verse 13 says, and after they had held their peace. Now, isn't that interesting? After they'd held their peace. You see, what James did is he waited for everyone to exhaust their feelings. And when they'd finally talked out everything they possibly could, then James said something. Actually, do you know what he did? James actually practiced what he preached, because this is what James chapter 1 says. You don't need to turn it up, but James 1 verse 19 says, wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrong. And that's exactly what he does in the conference, isn't it? He waits for everyone else to finish. He is the whole lot of them. He didn't get heated. He didn't get emotional. He calmly waited in the chair until everyone had said what they wanted to say. And verse 13 says, isn't it marvellous? You see, it says, when after they had held their peace, James answered. You see, they all argued. James answered. And what James was going to speak forth was going to be the answer to the matter. Men and brethren, hearken unto me, says James, as he begins to set forth now his answer to this controversy. Can you imagine the weight on his shoulders that day, brothers and sisters? Imagine summing up this matter and coming to a conclusion as the president of the assembly. I'm sure that everyone was probably thankful that James, by the way, was in the chair. I think he was a better man to be in the chair than Paul. And I'll show you why in a minute. I think he was a better man to be in the chair than Peter. But the burden of that responsibility must have hung heavily upon him. So now he's going to bring forth his answer. Verse 14. Simeon hath declared... Oh, Simeon. Oh, now that's interesting. Because do you know that the word Simeon is Peter's proper Jewish name? And not only is it his proper Jewish name, but it's the most In the Greek here, it's the form of the Greek that sounds the most like the Hebrew pronunciation of Peter's name. So you can imagine when he said, Simeon hath declared. Now, I can just imagine all the circumcision party rubbing their hands at the, and listening to that people saying, oh, he's with us, he's with us. Wait for it. He's going to rule in our favour. Simeon hath declared. And so then he says, Simeon hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name, and to this agree the words of the prophets as it is written. Now here was the crucial thing, brothers and sisters. You see, when all the talking was over and done, what was essential in this controversy was that the weight of scriptural argument was needed to carry the day. Not just the opinions of people. James had to bring forth a scriptural solution to the controversy. And by the way, it's not as easy, not nearly as easy as you might think it is. You see, what do you think the controversy of Acts 15 is about? Well, I can tell you it's not about whether the Gentiles should be saved. That issue has already been decided. All Jews, however reluctantly, the circumcision party's already lost that battle earlier on. It's already been agreed that Gentiles can be saved. But the crucial, burning question of the circumcision party and of this conference was, how can they be saved and what must they do? And whatever James says, he's got to bring forth a scriptural argument to solve this problem, because nothing more or less than a scriptural argument would solve all of these Jewish brethren listening and waiting to hear what he was going to say. Because the scripture at least would be, for both sides of this controversy, the infallible determinant. So, now look what he says therefore. Here's a scriptural argument. So, he says in verse 15, and to this agree the words of the prophets as it is written. And then he says this, after this I will return, build again the tabernacle of David that's fallen down. And what he seems to do in this particular section now, from verse 16 to verse 18, is he quotes three separate Bible passages. Three separate Bible passages. Now, have we got time to look them up? Yes, I think we should, just very briefly. So, hold your hand in Acts 15 and come to the first one, which is Jeremiah chapter 12. Well, we might turn up at least a couple of them. In Jeremiah chapter 12, I think this is the first passage that James is alluding to. Jeremiah 12, verses 14 to 16. And it says there, thus saith Yahweh, against all mine evil neighbours that touch the inheritance which I have caused my people Israel to inherit. Behold, I will pluck them out of their land, and pluck out the house of Judah from among them, and it shall come to pass that after that I have plucked them out, I will return. Oh, do you see that phrase, I will return? That's the first statement of James. After this, I will return. So the very first phrase of Acts 15, verse 16, we believe comes in all probability from Jeremiah chapter 12. Now, it's about Gentiles. But what does it say about them? Well, Jeremiah 12 says this. Now, look at this, verse 15. I will return and have compassion on them, and will bring them again, every man to his heritage and every man to his land. That's the Gentiles. And it shall come to pass, if they will diligently learn the ways of my people, to swear by my name, Yahweh liveth, as they taught my people to swear by Baal, then shall they be built in the midst of my people. Ooh, so you see, here was a prophecy about the Gentiles being built inside Israel and accepted by God. So you see, in this first passage that James refers to, those of the Gentiles, verse 14, would eventually be the recipients of God's compassion, verse 15, and that by espousing themselves to Yahweh, verse 16, would be included in the hope of Israel. And all of that's captured in the phrase in Acts 15 and verse 16 when it says, after this I will return, because it seems to be an allusion to this Jeremiah passage. Now, you notice what Jeremiah said, by the way, they shall be built. And that word built is the bridge now to the next passage that he's going to use, because the next passage that he's going to use is, I'll build again the tabernacle of David. Now, where does that come from, by the way? Where does the quotation about the tabernacle of David come from? Yes, it's from Amos chapter 9. Now, so hold your hand in Acts 15 for a moment and come to Amos chapter 9, and let's just see what it says. So what Amos promised is that the day was coming when the tabernacle of David would be revived. Because it says in Amos 9 verse 11, in that day will I raise up the tabernacle of David, the tabernacle of David that is fallen, close up the breaches thereof, raise up the ruins, build it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom and of all the heathen which are called by my name. Now, is that what Acts says, by the way? And the answer is no, Acts isn't quite the same. If you read the Acts version in Acts 15, it says, verse 16, I will build again the tabernacle of David, which is perhaps almost the same as Amos saying, I'll raise up the tabernacle of David. But whereas Amos says that they may possess the remnant of Edom, the Acts version says, verse 17, that the residue of men might seek after the Lord. So, now here's the question, therefore, where do you think James is quoting from? Any thoughts on that? Yes, he's quoting from the Septuagint. Now, do you know, brothers and sisters, the moment he said he's quoting from the Septuagint, I can imagine Paul and his company saying, he's quoting from the Septuagint version. He's with us. Just wait for it. It's coming. And the Apostle James quotes not from the Hebrew version of Amos, but from the Greek version of those scriptures. And in fact, his argument depends upon the Greek version and what the Greek version says. And what the Greek version said, in effect, was, when the tabernacle of David is rebuilt, then the Gentiles will be able to be associated with it, those who call upon the name of the Lord. Now, let's just summarize that, therefore. The revival of the tabernacle of David would be associated with the Gentiles seeking after the truth and receiving the sanction and approval of Yahweh. So here was another prophecy that said, yes, the Gentiles will come into the truth, and how will they come in? They'll come in through the tabernacle of David, says Amos. Now let's just pause for a moment here, and let me show you something really significant about the tabernacle of David. If you come back to the first of Chronicles, chapter 16, we're told that this is the very moment, I think, when the tabernacle of David was established, you see. And there's something really interesting here, and I'm sure that James was aware of this. Why does James refer to the tabernacle of David? That the Gentiles will seek God in association with the tabernacle of David. Well, this is what it says in the first of Chronicles 16, verse 1. So they brought the ark of God and set it in the midst of the tabernacle that David had pitched for it. So here's where the tabernacle of David begins. It was a tent that David pitched in Jerusalem for the ark of God. Now, do you know what's interesting about that? You see, what we're told in verse 39 of this same chapter is that Zadok the priest and his brethren the priests, they ministered before the tabernacle of Yahweh in the high place that was at Gibeon. So there were two tabernacles. There was a tabernacle in Gibeon, and there was a tabernacle in Jerusalem. The tabernacle in Gibeon had what? And the answer is all the relics of the Mosaic system of worship. The altar of offering, all the tabernacle furniture, in fact everything related to the tabernacle and the Mosaic system was in the tabernacle of Gibeon. Guess what was in the tabernacle of David? the Ark of God. And the Ark of God is the symbol of God's presence amongst his people. Now you see, what the tabernacle of David stood for there then was a system of worship that was outside, away from, different to the Mosaic system of things that was in the tabernacle of Gibeon. So I think it was extraordinarily interesting that James refers to the tabernacle of David, because what he's saying is there is a system of worship that the Gentiles can come in and be associated with, Amos 9, that's got nothing to do with the Mosaic order. Ooh, that was an interesting quotation, wasn't it? The tabernacle of David is to do with the law of Christ. And so James's argument is that when the Gentiles come in on the basis of the promise of Amos chapter 9, they don't come under the Mosaic order. He says that's the tabernacle of Gibeon. No, they come under the tabernacle of David, and yet that's where the Ark of God's presence is. And I think that the last passage that James is referring to is Isaiah chapter 45, when in Acts 15 and verse 18 he says, "Known unto God are all his works from the beginning of the world." There is a possible allusion here to Isaiah 45, which says that God knew from ancient times the fact that the Gentiles would be involved. God knew from the beginning that the Gentiles would come in. And so the drawing near of the Gentiles, verse 20, was always known to God, verse 21, whose salvation would extend to all mankind, verse 22, that they might submit, verse 23, and acknowledge Yahweh alone. So you see, what's happened here, brothers and sisters, is that James has given a scriptural basis for the resolution of the conflict. As president of the assembly, he not only summarized the arguments of the conference, but he also expounded the scriptural foundation for the inclusion of the Gentiles in the hope of salvation, and then proposed a motion to settle the issue. And so at the heart of his argument was this fact, that the scriptures he had adduced clearly taught that the calling of the Gentiles had been directly and specifically initiated by God himself. Verse 14, God at the first did visit the Gentiles. They had not received the truth by association with Judaism, nor under the Mosaic dispensation, but belonged instead to the dispensation of the tabernacle of David. The central code of this new dispensation was not the laws of Moses, but the law of Christ. And under that law would God directly accept those from among the heathen who sought him. The Gentiles had therefore been called as Christians under grace and not as Jews under law, and were therefore not subject to the code of the Old Covenant. The involvement of the Gentiles had always been known by God, whose determined purpose was to cause all nations to bow before him and acknowledge that he alone had the power to give salvation. It was a very powerful set of scriptural arguments, brothers and sisters. And James brought all that together in a very convincing way in order that he might give judgment on the matter. So having reasoned his way through the issue scripturally, what James is now going to do is in fact give his judgment in the matter. So when he says in verse 19, "My sentence is that we trouble not them which from among the Gentiles are turned to God." Well, now you see, now just let me take you back a bit. So you can imagine the ebb and flow of this meeting. So they've all said their piece and James has stood up. And they're all waiting to see what the president's going to say. And he begins by saying, "Simeon hath declared," he quotes from the Hebrew, "the circumcision party all say yes." And then he proceeds to say, "And to this agree the words of the prophets," and then proceeds to quote from the Septuagint, which is the Greek version. And Paul's party says, "Yes." And so then he says, verse 19, "Wherefore my sentence is that we trouble not them which from among the Gentiles are turned to God." And Paul's group would say, "Yes." And then he says, "But that we do write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols and from fornication and from things strangled and from blood. And the circumcision would say, this is getting better. And you see, James was walking the tightrope, wasn't he, of these two groups that he was trying to summarize among. So on the basis of his scriptural testimony, James proposed a resolution to the dispute. His statement was clear and decisive. Ego crino, I judge, or idiomatically, this is my vote. His motion was that Jewish believers should stop troubling the Gentile believers who had turned not to the law, but simply to God. The abstentions enjoined upon the Gentiles were designed to facilitate, they were designed as a transitional measure to facilitate social intercourse between Jewish and Gentile in every city, those Jews that preach them being read in the synagogues every Sabbath day. Now look at this next bit, because I think this is a good summary. Forbearance was asked of the Gentile believers in submitting to these few conditions. Forbearance was expected of the Jewish believers in exacting no more. Now that was an interesting resolution, wasn't it? So I'll just say that again, because I think that this is at the heart of the spirit of what James did here. Forbearance was asked of the Gentile believers in submitting to these few conditions. Forbearance was expected of the Jewish believers in exacting no more. And you see, what James did, therefore, is he made a ruling that I believe was sensitive to both parties in this transaction. Now, just stop and think about the reality of the story here. Was there a right side in this matter? And the answer is yes, there was, by the way. Paul's teaching was that everyone is justified by faith, and therefore we're not bound by the works of the law. Was Paul right? Yes or no, was Paul right? Yes, he was. So why didn't James simply say, Paul's right? But he didn't, did he? James gave a ruling that I don't think Paul would have given. And I think it was a wise ruling. You see, what he did was he appreciated where the Jerusalem Ecclesia stood at this particular moment. See, I think there are those who feel that James's ruling in Acts 15 was a compromise. People say, well, James should have ruled in favour of Paul because Paul was doctrinally correct. I think that James was a much better shepherd than that of the ecclesia. Because what do you think the result would have been if James had said, right, here's the end of the matter, there is only one truth, Paul is right, circumcision is unnecessary, and the keeping of the law is no longer obligatory, the Gentiles come in without any observance of the law whatsoever, that's the end of the matter. What would have happened if James had brought down that judgment on that day? Well, the first thing that would have happened is the circumcision party would have said, well, we're off. And they would have got up and walked out of the ecclesia. And some people would have said, well, good on them, good riddance. But you see, it's not the fact that the circumcision party would have left that's the problem. You see, in addition to the circumcision party, there would have been many others lost. Because you see, the circumcision party portrayed themselves as the strong ones in the meeting, those who were making a stand for the purity of the truth. And there would have been a lot of little ones in the ecclesia that would have said, Well, I'm not sure, but they seem pretty strong. I think we'll go with them. True? And there would have been a lot of little ones of the flock who would have been lost to the truth and gone back to Judaism as a result. And there would have been a terrible division of the ecclesia that was not in the best interests of the meeting. James instead asked forbearance from both sides. His objective was not to win a battle, but to win brethren. He sought to achieve, I think, what was best for the truth. And that, by the way, is never a compromise. It's what's best for the truth. Now, do you think there's any suggestion in Acts 15 that the decision that James came down with was wrong? No, I don't think so, because just read what the text says. Verse 19, my sentence is. Now look at the reactions and the balance of the chapter. Verse 22. Then pleased it the apostles and elders with the whole ecclesia to do what they were now going to do. So the whole ecclesia endorsed the decision of this conference. It says it pleased them. Look at verse 25. It seemed good unto us, says James when he writes his letter, being assembled with one accord. They were unanimous on this, brothers and sisters. The decision that James made actually pulled the ecclesia together, at least for the time being. And now look at this, verse 28. Oh, look at verse 28. It seemed good to the Holy Spirit. Now, what would you make of that then? It seemed good to the Holy Spirit to lay upon you no greater burden than these necessary things. You see, I think James is claiming that the decision that he made that day was qualified and endorsed by the Spirit itself. And the result of this, verse 31, was that when other ecclesias read the decision of the Jerusalem conference, they rejoiced for consolation at what had been decided. You see, when James stood up in that meeting that day, brothers and sisters, he knew that every member of the Jerusalem ecclesia was steeped in the law. Even the apostles still had Jewish prejudices. And James knew that the ecclesia needed time for education on the matter. Too many had fragile consciences in this thing. And what the decision of the conference allowed for was further time to educate on the correct principles. You know, brothers and sisters, even the scriptural teaching on the process that might lead to disfellowship, those scriptures teach patience and restraint and mercy. Well, that's exactly what James does here on this occasion. He doesn't simply push a decision that was doctrinally pure and correct, but would have resulted in the immediate and catastrophic division of the ecclesia. He instead asked for both sides, notice, both sides, to show forbearance to the other in the meantime. If James had simply said, let's chop them up and cut them out and clean it up, what he would have done was followed the spirit of the circumcision party, because that's what they would have done, isn't it? I believe, brothers and sisters, that the decision that James made in this chapter was in fact exceedingly wise. It was a terribly difficult decision, but I believe he made it in the best interests of the ecclesia that allowed the time for further spiritual growth and for further understanding of these principles. And as a result of this ruling, by the way, the Gentiles would forever be free from circumcision. That much had been decided at this conference. There was, of course, one thing that James could not possibly touch at this meeting on this day. Although he had ruled in favour of the fact that circumcision was not binding on Gentiles, he couldn't possibly touch the implication of that, which was, is it then binding on Jews? And the circumcision party noticed that. And they came back for another shot to discuss the one thing that the Jerusalem conference was never able to cover. That, God willing, is our next session.